Josh Salem and Mel Gurdov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Shirley Jihad, Mike Moan, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Mary Sherman. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. It's our spring membership hive drive, and now is a great time to support KBOO. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Alright, hey everybody, thank you for tuning into Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. Hey, reach out to us if you got questions, you're enjoying the show, you want to hear somebody, maybe we're saying something you have some problems with, give me an email, andrew@coastrange.org. We want to hear from you, appreciate all the listeners out there who've reached out. If you want to hear past episodes of the show, go to coastrange.org/coastrangeradio. And you can hear all of our past episodes. Today we've got a recurring speaker on the show, the man behind Coast Range Association. And we've got Chuck Willer here, co-director and principal researcher on the financial forestry agenda of the Coast Range Association. And here today we're going to be talking with Chuck about the next phase of Coast Range Association's work. The work that we just last year we produced the climate and industrial forest proposal, and we're going to be talking about how we're bringing that into more relief and focusing on building wealth and prosperity in rural Oregon and specifically the Coast Range. Hey, Chuck, how's it going?
Well, Andrew, thanks for having me on. Thankfully, I'm not a frequent person on this radio program, and that allows me the free time to do what I do best, which is research and try and think through solutions to the pressing problems faced by the Coast Range region.
So, yeah, what are we working on? What's next here that the Coast Range Association is focusing on with this revamp of the proposal?
Well, we came out with the proposal for a climate and forest body of work. We revealed an analysis of the timber industry and a set of solutions, which were innovative, one-off almost for nonprofit work in Oregon. And they were well received within the communities they were directed at. We've got plenty of feedback that was great. And I think we've changed the goalposts for a certain community of people concerned about forests. There were a number of ways that we built that document that were spoke to the period, which was strictly through the lens of a climate agenda. And I don't think we brought into relief really the wealth-building social benefit nature of what a transformation of the forest products industry, specifically the timber industry, could do for the Coast Range region. And so in addition to the fact that the document was too long, too wordy, too complicated, we needed a new analysis in a new document that would be more tractable and usable by people who live in the rural areas of Oregon. West Side forested region. And so 6 months ago, we started talking about this, prioritizing a new body of work. Now I think we're getting to a first draft I want to speak to today.
Nice. So let's get some background. You know, folks maybe haven't read the initial climate and industrial forest proposal that we put out there. People can go to coastrange.org and find that. What's going on in Oregon's forest? What's happening with these large industrial real estate investment trusts and TIMOs? What's the current landscape that we're living in?
Well, I think there's a body of work going back five, six years now that we've established that pretty well lays out the problem. The domination of rural landscape by Wall Street forest-owned firms, and the fact that Wall Street's perspective on forest management does not serve local communities. We've demonstrated in mapped form the extent of Wall Street ownership. We've put out information on problems of local taxation and the avoidance of local taxes in support of community services by Wall Street. And so we've laid out, I think, a fairly clear indictment of the current ownership of the majority of Western Oregon's industrial forests. And so our proposal that we came out now over a year ago made the contribution of, okay, how could this be changed? And of course, as anyone who's read the document or even the executive summary, which is available on the website, we identified the need for a change in ownership to social benefit ownership and a new form of enterprise instead of a for-profit corporations, something very similar to what rural people are very familiar with, rural electric co-ops, which supply electricity to much of rural Oregon. You know, that's all in that document. And that was innovative. I hadn't heard it spoken to before in Oregon's, in our work in Oregon, in the conservation community, in public interest discussions. And so the extension of those two, or the application of those two themes, set against a clear and deep analysis of the problem with a Wall Street owning firm, I thought we had a pretty good document, and it did. It's opened a lot of eyes. We need a new analysis that I believe speaks directly to rural residents, all residents, not just the educated or the choir that might normally come to a talk by me, but a document that speaks to all residents. So I'm hoping today to kind of illustrate and go through what that might touch on and what that might emphasize. And so what I'm going to speak to today is what we're going to do. I'm not going to go into what we're not going to do.
Nice. Good. Okay, so let's just jump right into it. We've got the background here clearly stated the problem. And you know, these timber firms, these Wall Street-owned forests are not working for people. What is the focus of this new document? How does it change the argument in the document from one based on, you know, carbon storage, climate, and social benefit to focusing more on the economic and wealth building in rural communities?
As we laid out in the previous document, where we spoke to ALICE-challenged households that are just living paycheck to paycheck, in much of the rural areas, 50% or more of households are living paycheck to paycheck or are formerly in poverty. So that economic fact is what we want to speak to. So this new analysis and layout of the issues will speak solely to the economic interest of rural residents via following the money. And that follow the money or follow the cash flow or however you want to frame it is really what matters to local communities. Is there income flowing into the community, or is there income flowing into rural households? Is there opportunity to make a living in rural communities? So our analysis will look at the large cash value of all the production that goes across Western Oregon and where the money goes from that production. How much is left locally? How much is not left locally? Where does it go? And I think that rural people living paycheck to paycheck might have a lot of values that are similar to ours, but their focus, their priority is going to be their immediate problem, their immediate self-interest, and their immediate survival. And I think it's very important to explain forests, forestry, and forest ownership in light of the stress on their lives. And as we do that, we will address what is represented as a similar agenda, and that's the timber unity agenda. Timber unity says they're for communities, they're for workers, jobs, and therefore their support growing rural economies. Well, I'm going to look exactly at what they're saying and what they're doing, and as we illustrate the reality, we'll evaluate whether there's a disconnect between the timber unity agenda and the reality of rural life. I don't think anyone's done that yet. The urban activists and everything, they characterize timber unity, it's almost a character that, you know, they're proto-fascist or they're this or that. You know, rural folks have a circle of priority of concerns. Many of them support the words spoken by timber unity, the what's on the website, what's on their Facebook page. I think our analysis will bring into relief whether those words really will get the job done, whether what their policies they advocate really speak to the interest of rural people. And I don't think that a fair analysis has been done by the urban policy people. And we'll do that. We'll evaluate the timber unity message, and we'll evaluate other things that are supposedly speaking to rural interests. You know, we'll briefly visit what's the problem. You know, which we're going to come right up and front load land dominant landscapes, land dominated by Wall Street forest owners. They're the productive engine out there in many of these rural communities, and they have a sizable production each year of logs and other things they sell off their land. So we'll briefly visit and illustrate the problem. What we'll focus on is the ever-growing percentage of land owned by Wall Street and the loss of small land holdings. When you lose when a family sells out and moves out of a rural area, that's a customer missing from the local supermarket. That's a customer missing from the local hardware store. And that income then becomes moves to the big city or a city. That is one of the key problems that rural economies face, not just in Oregon, but across the United States. As rural areas, some become winners, for various reasons, but most landscapes are losers as depopulation occurs in the area. So we'll speak briefly to that. This will be a very tight document. We're not going to get too wordy, but we'll go through those what's the problem issue on the landscape level and in communities throughout rural Oregon. Then we're going to move into a deep dive into the Wall Street forestry firm, not so much to illustrate many of the issues we illustrated in the previous analysis, but we want to focus here on following the money. So if you look at the 3 billion board foot of timber production each year in Oregon, all the sales of permits, fees, brush harvesting, hunting licenses, that used to be free to hunt on these lands. Now everything's monetized. If you look at the total sales off the timber, industrial Wall Street timber estate, where does that go? How much stays local? How much goes to the big cities? How much goes out of state? How much goes out of country? And so we'll look at that just from an ordinary business analysis. And that's basically in two ways the sale of all the revenues from these lands is broken down, which is the cost of production. That's the first way. And that pays all the wages that go into timbering. It also pays for all the equipment and fuel. Well, when you buy equipment, when you buy fuel for doing logging, hauling, that's all money that goes out of region. I mean, we don't make logging equipment here. And we certainly don't make fuel. Then the question is, well, how much money goes into labor, the cost of production? And, you know, most people think of loggers. Now, there's a sizable component of the workforce in these companies that is really technicals, professionals, all kinds of other people that support the actual logging and sales. And those people do not live out in the rural areas. Those people live in the cities. And so we'll take a brief review of the cash flowing in the cost of production, the cost of doing all the production that goes on to the landscape around communities, the forest. Well, then you end up with what's left over after you pay for the cost of producing all these things from Wall Street's land, and that's gross profits. And gross profits are quite large. And where do the gross profits go? Well, it's a no-brainer that the gross profits do pay for a lot of things that the company has to spend money on: insurance, advertising, legal fees, all kinds of costs like that are covered by the gross profits out of the out of production. All the lobbyists, all the donations to political candidates, those all come out of gross profits. But obviously, the goal of the Wall Street firm is to send money to the investors and the bondholders. I mean, all these companies are leveraged up. And that's another investor class. So we'll just briefly describe the massive amount of money that goes out of state, because the investor class is not based in the state of Oregon. The majority is in the United States probably, but 35% of all investor money in U.S. corporations is from out of country. So we'll follow the money as it goes from the sale off the land of timber and other values, and describe how it's allocated out. And the tiny amount that goes to labor, logging, hauling, and other things that are done generally by rural people, that all comes with a cost. The cost of living there, the cost of maintaining your life. We'll try and illustrate that. If you wanted a bad deal, a forest firm owned by Wall Street is a deal made in heaven. That's where you're going to get your worst deal you can imagine. It's made in heaven for the investors. And so this section two will emphasize how the cash flows from the timberlands, how it doesn't stay local, and how it goes everywhere else, including London, Saudi Arabia, and Russia, where people have invested in the financial pools in Wall Street that then own these companies. Now, we're also going to visit briefly a little forgotten history of Western Oregon's timbering history, but I don't think we can probably go into that today. And it's going to be a brief history, but I think it's very important to remind people of what these lands once were, what they became, and what they evolved into under Wall Street ownership. And then in the final part of our document, we're going to visit the solutions we offered in our original document of community ownership and community benefit business models. There, we'll emphasize how money can stay local. Just for example, if you have a Wall Street forest firm, they're obviously going to do everything they can for an efficient production, which means the least costs, which means the least money spent locally. But even if they didn't care about efficiency, let's say they were a monopoly firm and efficiency wasn't the sole thing they were concerned about, the ownership and the leadership of the company has no incentive or interest in hiring locally, in making sure money stays local. They would just as soon spend it on exorbitant professional fees and analysis that's done in Corvallis or Portland. So local ownership, when we say community benefit business model, is a business model that might be concerned and should be concerned with how much can we source locally? How can we encourage people to live local and not live in the big city, even though they're doing something connected to forest management? That kind of social benefit or community benefit business model will emphasize why it obviously, and in ways people might not think of, why it could benefit local communities. You know, the community ownership of forest, which is a theme that goes back 25 years in Coast Range work, is an assertion simply because current corporate owners, driven by financial investors, a business model that's strictly financially driven, they only change at the margins. 25 years late or 20 years late, they just increase some stream buffers under that forest deal. California and Washington got those 20 years ago. You know, so they can change in small ways, but you're not going to change the basic way the cash flows. You're not going to change the basic way the money flows unless you change ownership. And ownership is owning title to the land. So our focus has always been to elevate that issue and seek ways by which ownership could transition. I know people often take that assertion skeptically, but let me remind everyone, the ownership of those industrial forest properties out there have changed hands many times in the past. They're bought and sold every day. In fact, the financial owners could care less about the land. They could care less about what land they own. They want to own land that makes them money. So there's no like deep inherent blockage for creating the political circumstances that might allow those lands to be bought for communities. If they, let's say you had a large ownership that was held by a family, they might have deep roots in the land. They might not sell under any circumstance. But Wall Street owners care for nothing but money. They have no allegiance to land. They'll sell it if it's in their interests. And so we recognize the need to control and own land. We recognize how thin the claim is by these Wall Street owners on the land. We'll illustrate that in this new proposal. But I think the main thing that will be happening here is a real rural, residential, rural community-centric analysis that follows the money, explains why it's a bad deal for Wall Street to own the forest all around their towns, and how things could be different, offer hope, and provide specific avenues to explore in the future.
Nice. And get that out to not the choir, people who may not have seen this information in the past. And I think that's really valuable. You know, something, Chuck, that I've learned from you over this last couple years working together, you know, it's, you see it from both the conservation side, you see it in the timber unity messaging. You know, it simplifies, you know, talking about the timber industry as a whole, talking about timbering forests as a single entity. And it's something that you've really done in your work and made very clear. There's nuance there. There's the Wall Street owners compared to the rural communities, these community forests, federal forests, all these things. It's really important to understand the difference in where that money is flowing and where that power is accumulated. So thank you for that, making that really clear in this work.
Well, thank you, Andrew. And it's really not it's not any great insight on my part. If people are getting ripped off, I don't care whether they vote Republican, if they voted for Trump, whether they voted for Joe Biden. I don't care who they vote for. I don't care really what they say. if the basic circumstance, the basic real circumstance of their lives is they're getting ripped off every day, there is a knot to untangle and a story to tell that could get them to a true solution to their problems. And not scapegoating, not thinking that they're the solution to their problems is, you know, taking it out on someone else. You have to talk to what the actual circumstances are that are ripping them off, stressing them out, and causing them either to abandon the rural landscape or stay there and suffer and most likely embrace a bad politics. Now, Coast Range doesn't do elections and politics as such per se, but explaining the world where your interests lie and how you're being ripped off is something we have a long history of addressing. And so I think we have to continually make the effort to provide good information, real information to rural residents in the Coast Range, on the coast, in rural communities for all of Western Oregon that help them see a path to a wealth building and true future for their children. You know, it's not rocket science. The Wall Street colonization and domination of the landscape, and I mean, it's all on their websites what they do at the investor conferences. They brag about what they do. The words might not be familiar to rural residents, the investor words and everything, but when you understand the words they're saying, we're here to take all we can and leave. And people get that. I don't care what their political party, I don't care what their age bracket. I've talked to a lot of rural people. They all get it. They might not be able to articulate it in a clear business analysis or a clear policy analysis or a clear land ownership analysis. That's what a job for an entity like Coast Range Association is, you know, try and explain the world that helps people live better lives. And our expertise is in forestry, forest landscapes, forest communities, and how they might thrive into the future.
In a unique position, crossing over from conservation and seeing the failures or the lack of attention to caring for people from the conservation world, and but also understanding the interconnection between communities and resilient and vibrant ecologies and landscapes, and how that also plays in. So it's a unique position. Right on, Chuck. This is exciting work, and I think it's building a constituency and an understanding that is deeply needed for the current moment in time we see ourselves in. There's a lot of stresses. There's a really looking up towards some of these root causes of these issues is so important, instead of the kind of cascade of suffering that we experience today. So thanks for joining Coast Range Radio. Any last thoughts? I think you pretty much hit it.
Well, Andrew, as anyone that's read our newsletters over the past 20 years, there's one sentence I often use, and that's, our work brings people together. Now, oftentimes when you go to Salem, bringing people together means bringing, let's say, working folk together with business owners or investors, and let's all sit at the table and have happy talk. That's not what we mean when we speak to bring people together. What we mean is bringing residents of rural communities, people that actually live on the land, people that have common interests, no matter what political party, no matter what religion, no matter what other sets of agendas they have in their minds, bringing those people together to understand a common interest and a common future. And I've used that so many times in communications in the past, that where our agenda is intended to bring people together. And that's what we mean by that. And I think this document will be a real contribution to advancing unity amongst people and to solve their common problems.
All right, everyone, keep an eye out for that work. The Coast Range Association will be putting that out in the near future. Visit coastrange.org to sign up for our newsletter, stay connected, and we'll be discussing this more on Coast Range Radio. All right, thanks, Chuck. Thanks for joining us, and thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
At KBOO, we're always busy bees preparing wonderful programming for you to enjoy. Now, during our spring membership drive, we need some money to go with that honey. Help us raise $56,000 by May 28th to support our efforts to pollinate the media landscape with locally produced, independent, people-powered community radio. Donate right now at kboo.fm/give or tap the donate button in the KBOO mobile app.
How do oil companies deal with oil spills?
I don't know how.
Slick lawyers.
Oh, like slick, like oily slick.
It's time for the Children's Hour. Yay!